It's August 31st, half moon, waning moon, one prop, lunar observance day, 2021, and time keeps passing on relentlessly like a wheel that just keeps turning, keeps passing. This is what they call the Kala Chakra, the wheel of time, keeps turning, doesn't stop. Something, a reflection. I've been on a retreat for a couple of weeks. Very nice just to take some time for personal development, set down some of the duties of administrative duties in the monastery, and then taking some personal time. And I found on this particular two-week solitary retreat, I didn't spend that much time in formal meditation. I did have a good chunk of time in formal meditation, sitting and walking meditation, but also just over the years, just get more seniority as a monk, and acquire things, acquire gifts, just sorting out all the odds and ends, cleaning the kuti, cleaning the dwelling place, just laying everything out, what do I actually need, what do I actually use, getting rid of stuff. It's always nice to get rid of stuff. That sense of just shedding extra weight, shedding the stuff we don't need. And then also just studying different Dhamma teachings, looking at some suttas and some teachings from some of the Thai Ajahns, and just reviewing some of that, getting always good to get re-inspired and review and then get back in touch with the original aspiration, the original Dhamma aspiration. And there's some suttas I find quite striking, like Samyutta Nikaya. You find all these short suttas, short thematic suttas, and some of them really quite striking. Sometimes I find some of the simplest suttas to be the most striking, whether it's Four Noble Truths or Six Sense Bases, Five Aggregates, Five Khandhas, these basic teachings that the Buddha's giving. And a lot of these teachings, he just gives the teaching. He'll give the same teaching over and over and over again. And we might feel like, oh, we just want to flip through the pages of the Samyutta Nikaya because just like it seems very repetitive, but then when we really look into it, I think that repetition is there for a reason. And sometimes you read it and just see it in a slightly different way, or after you've been practicing for a while, you read it again and it has a different meaning and it's more applicable. So one that I was reading near the end of my retreat was just a simple little sutta on the Six Sense Bases. Eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind as the sixth sense base, the one that gets neglected sometimes. The mind, the Buddha class, the mind and thoughts as another sense base. And the Buddha's giving this short teaching on sense restraint, or what we call sangwara sila. Sangwara is usually translated as restraint in English, but I like to think of it more as composure. So like sense composure. Restraint doesn't really capture the feeling of it. So composing the sense faculties. And there's this sutta about when the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind, we receive the data, the contact. So the eye sees forms, the ear hears sounds, the nose smells odors, the tongue tastes, the body contacts tactile sensations, the mind contacts thoughts, perceptions, mental objects, what we call dhammas, with small d, and moods and so on. And so these six sense bases, and then when one is couple vocabulary words, itaramana, anitaramana. The itaramana is the positive aspect. So when there's the attractive aspect to the six sense bases, and one is One grabs onto it, one grasps onto it, one clings to it. When there's the anitta ramana, or the unattractive aspect of the six sense bases, then the mind is, by default, it'll push it away, want to get rid of it, want to get away from it. So then when one is not grabbing onto and not pushing away, when one is then has that sense of composure or equanimity within the experience of the six sense bases, the experience of our world, then the mind is, the mind becomes just gladdened. And when the mind is, then when the mind is glad, then there's a sense of, there's a sense of rapture. When there's a sense of rapture, then there's the, then there's, the body becomes tranquil. When the body becomes tranquil, then the mind is happy. So when the body is tranquil, then there's happiness. When the mind has happiness, then it gets to samadhi, it gets to concentration. When there's samadhi, then one sees things as they actually are, and when one sees things as they actually are, one is said to be dwelling with heedfulness, or dwelling diligently, dwelling well. And then on the flip side, when there's not a sense of composure with the six sense bases, then one is not glad, but one is agitated. And when one is not gladdened, then there's not rapture. When one doesn't have rapture, the body isn't at ease. When the body isn't at ease, there's no happiness. And when there's no happiness, there's no samadhi. When there's no samadhi, one does not see things as they actually are, but one sees a distorted, like, perception of reality. And when it's that way, then one is said to be dwelling negligently in the Dhamma. So I think that's very interesting, because there's this idea of gladness, that the path, very much the root of the development of all these good qualities, is just gladness. And so that is worthy of reflecting on, because sometimes we might have the idea that it's about clamping down. It's about being as tense and as rigid as possible, rigidly following the rules, rigidly following the text or the trainings. And the Buddha's coming back to just gladness. And how does that gladness arise? That's through the composure or the equanimity within the experience of the six sense bases. It's very difficult to do, because it can be very habitual, like just to want to try really hard. And it's kind of a paradox, because we do need to try really hard. We need to take the practice seriously, but at the same time the Buddha's saying gladness. And he's saying ease, and talking about well-being, contentment. And he's talking about the proper causes of that. So very simple, very straightforward teaching, but then having to just see it a slightly different angle, and then can have a real effect. Kind of another theme that was coming up for me was selfishness and unselfishness. And I was remembering this time when Longpo Liam was asked, what are the most, like, memorable times in your own practice, in your life? Like, what's been most memorable? So for those who, maybe the guests who don't know who Longpo Liam is, he's a student of Ajahn Chah, and he's the current abbot of Wat Pa Pong, and pretty much considered the head of our tradition right now. And so, and this is his 60th Vasa this year. He's been a monk for about 60 years. And so he was asked, like, in your life as a monk, like, what have been like the most memorable experiences? And he said that all the experiences where he was like putting others above himself, putting others ahead of himself, or all the experiences where he wasn't selfish, those were the most memorable, where he was truly able to do that. Those experiences were the most memorable. So I thought that was quite a striking answer. So that was kind of a theme during the retreat, because like I was doing a bit of walking meditation one day, and I was starting to feel a bit agitated, because like in a leadership role or in a big community, sometimes you think like, oh, there's this or that issue happening. You know, what am I going to do to deal with that? You know, how can I fix this problem? How can I, you know, tell this person what they need to hear, or teach this person what they need to be taught, or point out to this individual what they need to be pointed out to? Or and then I was getting a bit stressed out during this walking meditation, and I was kind of like, okay, come back to the breath, like Bhutto. And then the mind was kind of going on like, well, how do I encourage this person? How do I help this person? How do I fix this situation? How do I do this or that in the monastery? And then I started bringing up this reflection naturally came up about selfishness and unselfishness. And I was trying to come at it through a different angle to try to just cheer myself up a bit. And I thought, well, yeah, through this entire walking meditation, I haven't been thinking about myself. I've just been thinking about, like, how can I help these different situations? And then that kind of flipped it, and a lot of joy came up, and thought that was interesting. Just that acknowledgement that, oh, hey, I'm not actually thinking about myself here. Like, in the past, maybe when I was newly ordained, you know, I would be like, oh, you know, how do I work with this or that? What do I need to change about this or that in myself? Or how do I deal with this or that problem or whatever? And now it's like, oh, how do I fix that external situation? Or how do I encourage that particular person? But I wasn't really like focused on anything with myself, and that actually brought up a lot of joy. And not that that also wasn't a hindrance, because there was suffering involved with that, but trying to use that reflection on unselfishness to flip the mental state a bit, and then there was gladness, there was joy. That also links together with the first part of the reflection on just gladness. How do you develop that? So if we look at that in terms of sense composure that the Buddha is talking about, we have the mind and mind objects. So the mind was maybe giving rise to like a negative mental object, and I was trying to kind of get rid of it or push it away or fix it somehow. But then coming back to equanimity and not really giving rise to like discriminating between the signs and features of that negative mental object, coming back more to the middle, to equanimity, and then joy, gladness naturally comes up. The body becomes calm. Things aren't as tense anymore. So then there's more of a sense of ease and well-being. So that's what we're trying to cultivate, just to keep that in mind, that it's not really about being as rigid or as tense as possible, but it's actually about relaxing. And that has to be, we have to remind ourselves of that often, that yes, it can be difficult to live in the monastery. It can be difficult to have the lack of distractions in the monastery. It can be difficult to keep the precepts. But what's most difficult is just, for most of us, is just to relax. And just to, it takes a almost like a courageous intention just to be at ease, just to have a sense of, just to relax, just to settle into the rhythm here, not having to be anybody, just to be very ordinary. The daily schedule here is actually very easy. It's actually very easy, yet we still can make it into suffering. I remember getting upset with Ajahn Pasano when I was two, I think it was in my second Vasa, because I developed this perception that there was too much work here in the monastery. So I developed this very strong perception that basically, you know, the Ajahns were just driving us like slaves, and we were just working. They were just making us work really hard, and there was just no rest. And I was also I was feeling very stressed out and was very tense. And at that time, I didn't once reflect that we only work 2.5 hours a day, and that's just nothing. And it's actually not very much. So is my mind just making a lot out of it and making it seem like more than it was, but the reality of the situation was we work 2.5 hours a day. You could say we work 3 hours a day if you add in like doing dishes. You know, everything else is just extra. You know, whatever else we decide to do during the day, but then we get that open time in the afternoon that we can use for taking a rest or practicing. But because there wasn't that sense composure, and because there wasn't that gladness, and because there wasn't that happiness, and there wasn't that concentration, and there wasn't that seeing things as they are, then I developed that perception. So that's how those things develop. And that's hard to acknowledge, and it takes time to develop or mature out of that. So seeing how that process is working. And it's good to have high ideals too, with like the standards of training, the etiquettes in the monastery. It's good to have those ideals. You know, if we have high ideals for ourselves. But then also recognizing everybody's at wherever they're at. It's not good for us to impose our high ideals on others. You know, if we have high ideals for practice, not to feel like we need to expect that from anybody else. So just really developing that inward focus. Yeah. So that's kind of a little bit of just reflecting on that process a bit. That can also, when really that sense composure, that sangvara sila, that develops the gladness, the ease, the happiness, then qualities like metta or compassion, they just flow so much more easily, and they don't have to be forced, and we'll feel we have a sense of ease, so there's a natural sense of goodwill for ourselves and goodwill for others. And because we're relating to ourselves with a sense of ease, and we're holding things lightly, we're holding them like Ajahn Chah would say, yes, you have to pick things up in the practice. It's not that you don't hold anything, but you hold it like this. You hold it with your palm up. You don't hold it like this with a clenched fist. So we pick these things up, we pick these teachings up, and we hold them, and we pick the ideals and the trainings in the monastery up, but we hold them palm up, and we don't tightly hold them palm down. And if we tightly hold them palm down, we're going to be, you know, it's going to be tight and tense, and we might even punch other people with our ideals. We might go around punching people. Nobody wants that. So to hold things lightly. When we hold things lightly, then people see us and they see what we're holding, so they might want to hold it as well. But if we're holding things with a tight fist, then it's not, you know, people might see that we have tightness, but they won't really see the ideals. But we're opening it with an open hand. We can be handing it to people. That's how we abide. That's how we live with each other. That's how we try to create a good example for each other, and also like things that are valuable or important in the monastery, like kindness in a big community. Kindness is very important, and kindness, gentleness, and then just remembering why we're actually developing these things. So big picture, these things are developed for the sense of, say, on an ultimate level, we're not really developing these things for this life, to cultivate something in this lifetime. It's actually something, it's like provisions for the journey. So a lot of the great Ajahns, great Dhamma practitioners in all traditions, they talk about provisions for the journey, you know, developing our practice, not to try to get something good in this lifetime. So it's weaving that kind of sense of unselfishness back into the practice. So we're not trying to get something good for this lifetime, but we're actually making provisions for the journey, for something that goes beyond this lifetime. That also, thinking like that also develops a sense of ease and well-being internally, because then we don't feel like, oh yeah, I have to kind of eke out as much pleasure or as much refinement of pleasant feeling as I can from this lifetime. So when it's no longer about cultivating pleasant feelings, but we have that sense of non-attachment, we have that sense of letting go of a thought of result, or that sense of a lack of craving, and letting go of expectations in the practice. So we might have a good experience in meditation, and then we try to get back to it, and we can't. This is a very common experience for meditators. But we have that expectation. So every good experience, every refined experience we have, whether it's in or out of the monastery, so every good and refined peak experience we have in our life, then we're going to gauge everything else by that. We cling to that, we attach to that, and we gauge everything else by that, and that causes suffering. So that the good, the peak experiences in our life, they end up causing us suffering, because then we gauge everything else by that. But if we don't expect to get to that experience again, or we don't have an expectation that it's going to happen again, there's that sense of non-attachment, non-clinging. And then the paradox is, then it gets better and better. And we keep not attaching, keep not clinging to it. So that's kind of the art of practice, the way of non-clinging, the way of non-suffering. So when Lungpur Sumedho talks about the way of non-suffering, he's talking about the way of non-clinging. So that leads to deep ease and well-being. But we're no longer looking for those peak experiences. So it's not about trying to get a certain experience, but it's about that relinquishing the expectation for a certain experience. So on a very deep level, that's the craving. That's the craving in the Four Noble Truths. That's the tanha that needs to be relinquished. Yeah, tanha is the samudaya, the cause of dukkha. Such an easy, such a straightforward teaching, easily overlooked. Yeah. That craving is the cause of suffering. It's easy to overshoot that teaching. It's easy to not just overlook it, but overshoot it and want it to be, well, it must be more than that. It must be more complicated than that. It must be more difficult than that. It can't be that simple. I remember one teacher saying, we don't see the Dhamma because it's too close. It's too right there. It's too us. It's too apparent here and now. So we don't see it. We overlook it. We overshoot it every time. It's all around us. It's every single moment. And it is us. You know, we are the Dhamma. We are the Dhamma of impermanence. You know, we are the living Dhamma. That's the Buddha's pointing to. The living Dhamma of the body, of aging, of death, you know, of craving, of suffering. These are all living things. These aren't words in a book. They're very alive and apparent here and now, and tangible. So learning how to relax, that's the first step, that sense of sense composure. And when we learn how to relax, then maybe we'll experience a bit of gladness. And when we experience a bit of gladness, then maybe we'll start to calm down, settle down a little bit more. Body becomes calm, and happiness arises. When happiness arises, then samadhi has a chance to arise. Then there's knowledge and vision of things as they are, or seeing things just according to their true nature. So those are just things that are very natural truths that are worth thinking about. When Prapayuto, he translates Buddhism as the religion of natural truths, or insight into natural truths. But we need those qualities in place. We need to feel that gladness. We need to feel that ease to start to have some ground to stand on so we can actually see clearly, and then it won't always be this kind of fuzzy mirage. Oh, okay. It's just that way. That's just how it is. Huh. Okay. Great. That's just how it is. And not saying it is this way or it is that way, but it is just this way. This is the experience here and now. So those are a few little ponderings, thoughts for this evening. I'll leave it there for the Dhamma talk.